Our first case for argument this morning is Kerr v. Hickenlooper, case number 12-1445. We are ready to hear from the appellants, and I understand each side has 25 minutes.
May it please the Court, I'm Dan Domenico, Solicitor General, appearing on behalf of Governor John Hickenlooper. Each of the 50 states draws a different set of lines dividing the power of government between the people and those who represent them. The lines drawn in Colorado certainly aren't always easy on our legislator. Article 5 of our Constitution reserves to the people the power to amend, reject, approve, supersede, otherwise undo anything that our legislature might choose to do. Our Constitution famously is among the easiest in the country to amend. It limits legislative discretion and authority in countless ways on countless topics, ranging from whether or not we can accept the Olympics, to defining felonies, to banning the detonation of nuclear bombs.
Could the population in Colorado, by amendment, abolish the legislature?
Your Honor, they have the power to do it. I think that Article 5 says that the legislature is acting on behalf of the people. So the delegation is from the people to the legislature. More to the point, though, for purposes of this court, at this point, until the Supreme Court reverses specific states in particular, the Supreme Court has told us that it's not the province of the federal courts to decide when a state may have crossed the line from Republican.
But isn't Pacific states a lot different than our case, in that there they were doing away with the whole procedure of initiative?
I don't think Pacific states is distinguishable in any relevant way. In Pacific states had a number of claims. The court lists the six claims. There was one very broad claim that the initiative process, period, was unconstitutional. Mm-hmm. There was also a narrower claim that the particular action taken, a tax measure, was unconstitutional. And there was also an Enabling Act claim, just like there is here. The court could have, I assume, written an opinion that said, well, what we're going to do here is empower the courts to draw fine distinctions and say, well, this particular tax measure is okay under the guarantee clause, but we'll leave it to future courts to decide when a state may have gone too far. But the Pacific States Court didn't do that. It very clearly, in the very first paragraph of the opinion, says we're answering two questions here. Is it the province of the federal courts to decide when a state may have lost its Republican form? And is it the province of the federal courts to enforce the guarantee clause? The answer to both of those questions was no. Unless the answer becomes yes to those questions, that is binding in this case.
But that's not the question before us, correct? The question before us is standing.
Well, certainly before you get to justiciability, you have to address the jurisdictional question of standing. So,
The answer is
the initial question certainly is standing, and I'm happy to discuss standing.
Are you conceding it?
Absolutely not. No, we absolutely don't concede that any of the plaintiffs have standing. The district court relied on one particular theory, legislator plaintiff standing.
Well, let me ask you this. If by a constitutional amendment the people of Colorado strip the legislature of the power to raise taxes, period. That's out of their jurisdictional purview. Would the legislature have standing to challenge that issue before the federal courts under the enabling clause?
There's no precedent for that, Your Honor. I mean, state constitutions, the federal constitution, what they do, their nature is to strip legislatures of the authority to do something. So, for example, this past year, Colorado stripped the legislature of the authority to ban, prohibit marijuana possession and use. I know of no precedent that suggests that a legislator who feels that they should have that authority back would have standing under Coleman or Raines. Raines is very clear that legislative standing
But isn't the stripping of power here much more broad in that there is no authority to appropriate?
No, it's actually not much more broad. Just Judge Lucero's example, where if the state had simply said no authority to raise taxes at all, would be equally broad, just on a different topic. The legislature has no authority now in Colorado over marijuana prohibition. What Tabor does is it requires the legislature, it leaves in place a significant role for the legislature in taxation policy. It just has to, before Tabor, without Tabor, in order to raise taxes.
So you wouldn't concede that the complete stripping, 100% stripping of the power of the fisc, that is the tax-raising power of the fisc, would not, you don't even concede that would give the legislature or some portion thereof standing.
The Raines is very clear on the narrow scope of legislator standing. Three things have to happen under Raines for legislators in their official role asserting a diminution in power to have standing. One, they have to vote for a specific bill. Two, they have to have a sufficient number of votes to pass that bill. And three, it has to then have been nullified. I suppose it would be possible if after...
Is Raines applicable to this situation? I mean, I understand the law generally is, but I mean, are the facts analogous in any way?
I think they're quite analogous. Raines, the exact same types of arguments were made by the plaintiffs in Raines. They argued that what had happened with the line item veto was that their entire relationship between the legislative and executive branch had been changed. I think the lower court had held that they had become immediately subservient to the president. Ultimately, of course, in City of New York, the Supreme Clinton versus City of New York, the Supreme Court agreed on the merits.
Yeah, but that was a federal case, correct? I mean, it was the federal.
Oh, sure.
And
sure.
In this case, it isn't. It's a state case in which members of the legislature are asserting that they have standing to raise the question. I'm not speaking to the merits.
You know, sure.
That's not in our bailiwick. But here the assertion is that at least the federal court should hear their case.
Absolutely, and that's exactly the same argument that the plaintiffs made in Raines.
But yes, Raines but didn't Raines, involve the enablement clause.
Raines didn't overturn Coleman.
No, it didn't, but it made very clear that it applies only in limited circumstances that don't apply here.
When your vote is nullified.
When you allege a specific bill was voted on that the plaintiffs...
Doesn't say that when it talks about Coleman.
Actually, Your Honor, I urge you to look at page 824. It says the reason the plaintiffs in Raines fail is that, one, they didn't allege that they voted for a specific bill. Two, that they had sufficient votes to pass it, and three, it was then nullified. This is precisely the situation the plaintiffs were in.
Can they allege the act will nullify their votes in the future in the same way that the votes of the Coleman legislatures had been nullified. So what's the difference?
That's right.
What's the difference between Tabor nullifying the votes of the legislature on tax issues and Coleman?
The difference is the legislature had proposed it, in Coleman, of course, it was a little bit different because it was ratification of a constitutional amendment. But essentially what happened in Coleman was the legislature had a majority of votes to enact, ratify the amendment. And it was undone. Here we would be in that situation if the plaintiffs could point to a instance of the legislature passing or even maybe alleging that they right now have a majority to pass.
Why do they have to do that when they're not talking about particular tax? They're talking about their power to act.
Well, that's exactly what Raines said. That's what the complaint was in Raines. We're talking about our power to act.
Circumstances were totally different.
Oh, you're right. They weren't in any relevant way. I mean, Raines is very clear. Coleman is limited to an actual vote on an actual measure that is undone, nullified. What Tabor does, again, is it essentially gives the people a veto over tax measures, just like the line item veto gave the president.
Is that correct?
Excuse me.
Go ahead.
No.
Go ahead.
Is that correct? Does it give the people a veto, or does it require an affirmative act on the part of the people?
Well, without Tabor, what was required to pass a tax increase was these plaintiffs would have to convince a majority of their colleagues in both houses to support it, and then it would be subject to approval or disapproval of the president, of the governor. Here, you have essentially the same thing. The legislature still, both houses have to pass it, and then the approval or disapproval is there. It's just the people have to approve or disapprove. So essentially it is. The mechanism is slightly different. Article 5 uses essentially
which is
this.
Much greater burden, isn't it? I mean, doesn't Tabor just basically handcuff the legislature?
I don't think so, Your Honor. I mean, the legislature has proposed alterations in 2005 to parts of Tabor. The people have voted for it. Tabor applies to local governments. They have a very strong record of both exempting.
So the legislature should just keep nibbling away at Tabor? That's the answer here?
Well,
they can fix their own problem?
Well, that's what the courts have said in Risser, in Largesse. Mm-hmm. That is exactly right. That just because it's a little bit harder doesn't make us un-Republican. And again,
let me pause at this question for you, because I'm trying to test first principles of standing as to your position
sure.
on them. Let us assume that the people adopt an amendment essentially making Hickenlooper a dictator. Is there standing when a structural change has been made in government, which the legislature contends conflicts with its enabling clause.
Under Raines.
With the enabling clause.
Until.
So just answer that question first. I mean, because I'm trying to find
sure.
out when you think they're standing.
As soon as Governor Hickenlooper started dictating, then there would be standing. That's the difference between Raines and Clinton versus City of New York. As soon as the president used this structural power that was alleged to be unconstitutional, then it created standing. But until he actually uses that power in a way that causes a concrete injury, simply alleging diminution in power isn't effective. So for legislators,
so you concede that at some point there
sure,
is standing.
Sure, absolutely. As
well,
soon as
the, a bit of a relief because I couldn't figure out when you thought there might be standing.
When the allegedly unconstitutional power is used to nullify something the legislature has done, then you go from Raines to Coleman.
And that's what you would require is a nullification as opposed to absolute prohibition from the outset.
Sure.
Isn't that what Tabor does? You can't go there, legislature. This is the line, and you cannot cross it.
Again, that's Judge Lucero's hypothetical. What it says is, in order to pass a tax increase, you have to get approval from the voters.
Right.
Now, if you want to challenge that power under Raines, just like if you want to pass in Raines an appropriations bill, in that case, they had structurally changed. The allegation was, ultimately, that the Supreme Court agreed with, that they had structurally changed in an unconstitutional manner the relationship between the legislature and the president. Here, that is exactly the same argument, and the Supreme Court said that's not enough. You have to actually point to a specific measure that would have gone into effect, but that this allegedly unconstitutional power in real life affected.
So if there is a proposed bill in the Colorado legislature that would want to raise funding for education, you just have to float that balloon, even though you know it's not going to go anywhere under Tabor. Is that what you have to do?
Well, you don't know that it's not going to go anywhere. It's not that you have to try to violate.
Well, doesn't Tabor tell you that it's not going to go anywhere?
No, it just tells you that you have to get approval of the voters in order to have it go anywhere. And so until they've actually tested that and the power has been used to nullify something they did,
okay,
then...
So this lawsuit is premature then?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. Unless they were to point to something that Tabor actually impacted, and they specifically disclaim any effort to do that. Page 44 of the brief says whether or how these powers, if the federal courts were to rearrange them, whether or how they would be used any differently is not the issue. They simply want restoration of what they view as constitutional government. That is simply a Lance versus Kaufman desire, abstract desire to have the law followed. It's not a concrete injury. Page 37 makes the same point when they try to point to their concrete injury as simply the deprivation of what they view as constitutional government. That is inadequate to assert a case or controversy under Article 3. So not only do none of the legislators, for essentially the same reasons, none of the plaintiffs have standing. Until this power that they're complaining about is actually used to impact things, then there is no standing. We are in the situation of Raines versus Byrd. Certainly, if this power came into effect, I mean, a couple of years ago, the legislature considered, or at least a few legislators considered, passing a tax increase precisely what the hypothetical you suggested, considered passing a tax increase. Had that passed through the legislature and then been voted down, nullified, then I think you would be in the Coleman situation, and you probably, depending on the details, would also be in the Clinton versus New York situation where someone on the potential receiving end might have had a claim. So that certainly it's not that nobody will ever have standing under Tabor.
So you're saying that the legislature, through this mechanism, could manufacture standing?
Well, sure. I mean, if what they want to do is raise revenue, they can try. I don't think it's manufacture in the sort of sense of do something artificial. What they have to do is what the...
Oh, I'm not proposing anything artificial. I'm just listening to what you're telling me.
Sure. What Raines teaches is that if you're concerned about a shift in power like this that diminishes legislative power, what you have to do is see if it actually, wait until it's actually used to diminish your power. So you go from Raines to Clinton versus City of New York,
so
or from Raines to Coleman.
The legislature basically could not be a bunch of law-abiding folks and test the law, challenge the law as unconstitutional. They've got to act like a bunch of outlaws, that is to say, contrary to the law, before they can get the courts to hear.
No, that's not right, Judge Lucero.
Where am I off the beat?
Sure. Well, think about, again, the comparison between Raines and then Clinton versus City of New York. The legislature wasn't required by Raines to essentially ignore the law. They were required to pass their bill and then went, and then if the president used this allegedly unconstitutional power, then it would actually cause a concrete injury.
Here under Tabor, they can never pass the bill. I mean, it's the language of Tabor. Any new tax, and then on and on, must have prior voter approval.
So maybe there's just confusion about how it works. The way a tax increase would work.
Apparently, the legislators feel that it works in that fashion, that they, before they can do anything on the issue of taxation, they have to have prior voter approval.
That is not how it works.
Okay.
Before it can go into effect, there has to be prior voter approval. The way a Tabor tax increase would work is the legislature would pass a tax increase,
mm-hmm.
and then it would be put to a vote of the people after they pass it. And I apologize. That is how it would work. So it would work just like an appropriations bill under Raines. The legislature passes the bill, and this is what happened in 2005 on kind of tweaking the revenue issues. The legislature passes an effort to raise taxes, and then it goes to a vote of the people. So what What they have to do is not ignore the law. They have to comply with the law. And then if the people use that vote to nullify what the legislature did, then I think you're out of Raines and you're into Coleman.
I guess what we're dancing on is whether it's prior voter approval or just a voter approval someday.
And exactly. And what prior means, the way it's been interpreted and the way it's been applied, is prior to going into effect. So the legislature can pass a measure, and then it would be voted on by the people. So there's two ways now in Colorado to raise taxes. One is that process. Legislature votes, suggests a tax increase to the people, and then the people have a vote. The other is essentially an initiative process where the initiative takes place, the initiative process, and then a vote. So both of the sort of initial process is either an initiative or essentially a referendum under Tabor, and then the vote, and it's prior to going into effect. So it's not true that the legislature has no role under Tabor. It's just that there has to be a vote of the people before.
Would you admit they have a diminished role? It's not like it is in most states. They have the power of the FISC, and they pass bills saying we are going to increase funding to higher education.
It's different. It's certainly different than in other states.
And so their powers are limited.
Their powers are subject to a different check than they were before. If I can reserve the balance of my time.
Sure. Thank you.
May it please the Court, Chief Judge Briscoe, David Skaggs appearing on behalf of the plaintiffs, and with me at council table is Michael Feely and Herbert Fenster.
Good morning.
Good morning. Legislators, elected officials, citizens of Colorado have brought this action to vindicate and enforce the promise of the United States Constitution and the Enabling Act that the government of Colorado be and be maintained as a Republican form of government. The Colorado Taxpayer Bill of Rights, by removing essential powers from the Colorado General Assembly, violates that guarantee of a Republican form of government.
How do you respond to his, is it true that Tabor works the way he says it works? The legislature proposes a tax and then the people vote on it?
It may work that way, Your Honor. That is, the legislature may refer a matter to the people, but it basically Tabor establishes a plebiscitory democracy in Colorado with regard to a whole range of issues that it covers, taxation, mm-hmm. certain spending limits, requirements for refunds. So the legislature's plenary powers that existed before and which we believe are absolutely requisite to a Republican form of government have been deprived by Tabor.
One thing that I failed to glean from the very, very good batch of briefs that we had before us was whether the Colorado Constitution was before Congress at the time of the passage of the Enabling Act, or whether it was adopted after the Act.
No, it was adopted after the Act and in compliance with the Act's requirement that Colorado have a Republican form of government. So the recitation of the Enabling
Congress
Act.
Congress has never actually officially passed in any way or reviewed in any way the Colorado Constitution for constitutional purposes.
The original Constitution of the state had to be certified as in compliance with the Enabling Act, I believe, by the U.S. Secretary of State that certification approved by the President of the United States at the time. So
and
that was the review
process.
Who
determines
process.
Whether the certification should be granted?
I don't know, Your Honor. I am pleased to address in sequence, I think, the issues first that have been brought up already with counsel for the state, the question of standing under both the Enabling Act, which is a separate question and very distinguishable from the question of standing under our constitutional claim. And likewise, should we get there, the justiciability issue, both under the Enabling Act and under our constitutional claim. I think this Court's holding in the Branson versus Romer case makes clear that we have standing under the Enabling Act. In the Branson case, as the court will recall, the challenge was to a change in the Colorado Constitution that allegedly violated the mandate for the use of the trust lands in Colorado for the benefit of education. Here we have a violation of the Enabling Act alleged that would run contrary to the requirement for a Republican form of government. In Branson, this court stepped through all of the Lujan criteria for standing and concluded that, in effect, there the district court's analysis of standing would hold, and in particular, that because of the Enabling Act violation, we have a supremacy clause violation as well, and the court there determined that there was essentially a private cause of action, an analogy that was apt to establish standing for the plaintiffs in Branson. In the constitutional claim, in which perhaps Raines is implicated, I would call the court's attention to this court's holding in Initiative and Referendum versus Walker from 2006, an en banc decision, in which this court determined that there was standing by the plaintiffs in that case anticipating what was described as the chilling effect of restrictions on their ability to pursue certain initiatives in, I believe it was Utah. And the court there determined that for purposes of standing, the validity of their constitutional claim, their First Amendment claim, had to be assumed, and that therefore, assuming that there was a constitutional violation, that the plaintiffs there had standing under their constitutional claim. The holding in Walker was reinforced by this court the next year in Day versus Bond, which says that the Walker demands that we assume during the evaluation of standing that plaintiff will prevail on his merits argument, that the constitutional violation alleged results in Article III standing injury with sufficient concreteness and particularity. Let me address, because it took up a good deal of time in my colleague's conversation with the court, the question of legislator standing, which is not the only basis, but it was the basis that the district court used. In our view, Raines is simply inapplicable to the circumstances of this case. I happen to be a plaintiff in Raines in a former life, and am painfully familiar with the holding there.
So this is your second coming?
God willing. But what was not yet discussed about Raines, which is absolutely critical, is that that was a separation of powers issue. It was a conflict between different parts of the first branch of government that was asking the third branch of government to intercede with the second branch of government.
Which is why I asked whether it's even relevant to our...
A classic separation of powers, political question, set of circumstances. And importantly, along with the other things that were said by the opinion in Raines, which is not entirely a clear holding, that the legislators there, I was one of them, still had recourse to their colleagues to persuade them of the error of their ways. That's not here. No legislator can go to the rest of the General Assembly under the circumstances of this case and say, let's get our taxing power back. It's gone.
Well, what about the discussion that we had with opposing counsel where he's saying, you know, you all can do what you need to do, and whatever you want to do, you can go ahead and pass a revenue increase, a trial balloon, if you will, and put it up to the vote of the people.
No, I don't think there's any requirement for standing purposes or otherwise for the General Assembly to go through a charade in order to establish the grounds for this case.
But is that how it works? I mean, I'm sort of caught up on what I thought the facts were as far as what Tabor requires.
Tabor gives alternative paths to a goal that it permits, which is voter approval of tax measures. That measure can get to them for approval either by referral from the General Assembly, which has no legal effect by itself, or by an initiative of the people. But ultimately, this is a plebiscitory system for purposes of the policy issues that Tabor covers.
Well, is it your position that the people of Colorado could not adopt a direct democracy as a state form of government and still be a republic?
Your Honor, they cannot do that. The Guarantee Clause and the Enabling Act both require a republican form of government, and it is, I think, manifest from the writings of the framers of the Constitution in the historical context of their day that they contemplated state governments that were representative democracies in which the legislatures played a central role and had to have the power to tax. Hamilton is clear, without the power to tax, there is no effective government.
And the power to elect, and we're told by one of the briefs, the power to elect the United States senators at the time, and that certainly couldn't be done by plebiscite.
Well, Your Honor, the early days of the Republic are replete with various expressions, both in the Constitution and in the Federalist Papers and in the commentaries of the time, of the founders' mistrust of direct democracy. You know,
sure.
This is offensive to our contemporary ears and population, but that was the system that was established, and they thought for very good reason.
Does that mean you can't have any initiative system?
Your Honor, no, and this case is very narrowly drawn to deal only with Tabor and its complete removal of a core power from the Colorado legislature. We do not challenge the initiative power generally, except when it goes to something that is structurally central to the maintenance of a republican form of government. The governor's briefs and many of their amici would have the court stand on the precipice of a slippery slope, that if somehow our case goes forward, Western civilization will crumble because all initiatives will be called into question. Not the case. On standing, I would submit that our case is Coleman on steroids. You know, that was a single vote nullification. As Your Honor has already pointed out in questioning, we're out of business on a whole range of core policy issues. It's not one vote nullification. It's putting all sorts of things completely off limits.
Or is it sort of off limits? I mean, again, you can pass a bill, I guess, because it's not actually a law. You pass something, and it would go to the people for vote. So are you out of business? I mean,
well, the legislature itself is deprived of the power to fund the necessary business
and
of state government.
And that's what you want. You want to begin and end and have the whole thing.
And without challenging, however, Your Honor, the residual ability of the voters, if they want to challenge an enactment of the legislature, they are still empowered to do that under the Constitution. It's just that they don't have a prior approval of a legislative power in this realm.
But that's somewhat analogous to the present limitations on the power of the legislature. For example, the Constitution requires that the budget be balanced from year to year, that you not have deficit spending. So the legislature is already under some limitations, constitutional limitations, that certainly meet the criteria for the establishment of a republican form of government.
That is correct, Your Honor, as it is also subject to a gubernatorial veto if it does pass a tax bill. So, you know, it's not as if the legislature becomes all-powerful under the restoration of republican government that we advocate. And there are other constraints that we do not challenge that are not compromising, again, the core quality of republican governance. What is the issue here is the essential devolution of fundamental powers of republican governance to plebiscitory democracy, something that was abhorrent to the founders, and that's why they wrote the Constitution the way they did. Obviously, these are issues to be elaborated on the merits if this court determines to remand for further proceedings.
We are told by some of the members of the legislature that they do not join in this request, that they feel that the legislature has that power already or is not qualified in an impermissible manner. What say you to that?
I will let them speak for themselves, Your Honor. I don't know that it's pertinent to the disagreement that they may have with the plaintiffs in this case That,
does that make it a political question?
It does not, Your Honor. Not in the sense that political question is a matter for this Court's determination of justiciability. I think Justice Brennan's admonition in Baker v. Carr that not all cases that raise political issues are political question cases. The definition of political question is drawn much more narrowly in Baker v. Carr, and for starters, is completely irrelevant to our statutory claim, in which Judge Kavanaugh and the Schieffer pharmaceutical case made the point very clear. The Supreme Court has never found a political question doctrine issue in a statutory interpretation matter. So on our Enabling Act claim, I think we're on solid ground there. I'd also, again, legislator standing, call the Court's attention to the case of Michael versus Anderson in the D.C. Circuit and other cases cited in our brief which have held legislator standing under circumstances where clearly, as we have here, legislators were individually and concretely harmed. I also want to stress the standing of our educator plaintiffs, and this was well briefed, I think, by the amicus brief submitted on behalf of the Association of School Boards and School Executives.
Did Lobato, the second Lobato Supreme Court opinion, undermine that argument?
To the contrary, Your Honor, I think it reinforces our standing because it makes clear, one, that there is a very real controversy alive in this state as to the adequacy of school funding. The Lobato Supreme Court decision merely determined that some constitutional minimums were met. What it didn't address was the ability of our educator plaintiffs and others to seek redress from the General Assembly to do more than the minimum under the state education clause, to be able to get adequate funding. And under the Colorado Constitution, school boards share a constitutional responsibility with the General Assembly to assure adequate funding for the K-12, the P-12 educational system. And again, with Tabor standing in the way, as was admitted by the defendant in the Lobato proceedings, we can't do better by way of education funding because Tabor is in the way. With it in the way, our educator plaintiffs, again, would be forced to go through essentially the empty gesture of approaching their representatives in the General Assembly to say, can't we do better by education funding? And the only answer to that from the legislators is, sorry, Tabor makes it impossible for us adequately to fund the schools.
How could, in on some hypothetical situation, the public play a role other than through the election of its legislature in limiting taxation?
Well, we are not in...
Obviously, they can vote the jerks out of office.
Which I think is the central check on legislative power and one that has served the nation well for a long time. Under the initiative and referendum provisions of the Colorado Constitution, a group of citizens can petition for a particular tax change. That's how Amendment 64, dealing with the marijuana situation, arose. And we will now have on the ballot for voter approval a tax to deal with the implementation of Amendment 64. So that mechanism is there. Likewise, absent the adoption of a safety clause by legislation passed and enacted by the General Assembly and signed by the governor, the people have the right to challenge a statute enacted by the legislature through the initiative process as well. So we are not wanting for checks and balances with authority in the people of the state. The question is, how far can you go? And in our opinion, Tabor steps over the boundaries of Republican governance. If the Court please, I wanted to speak briefly on the question of justiciability, in particular the hang-up that we seem to have with the Baker versus Carr tests, which we can run through them. I would really say that our amicus brief from the constitutional law professors does a very nice job of explaining, one, why they don't apply, but even if they do, they are met. But one of the things that does come up in the Baker Carr opinion is at least a suggestion that the federal courts pay some deference to coordinate branches of government. That's really inapplicable here, unless one looks to the suggestion in Rizzo versus Good that there should be some sensitivity to state pronouncements. So the Colorado Supreme Court happens to have made a pronouncement in the case of Morrissey versus State, and it remarks that the framework of our Republican form of government, I'm quoting, created by the Guarantee Clause, it is the Guarantee Clause that assures the role of elected representatives in our system. Supreme power rests with the citizens entitled to vote and is exercised by representatives elected by them, unquote. There are several other cases cited in our brief that show that the federal courts, including the United States Supreme Court, have entertained Guarantee Clause claims and found them justiciable. Doesn't mean they've agreed with the claim and found a violation, but they've certainly been justiciable. White versus Texas, Minor versus Hapstadt, several other cases as well that are cited in our brief. Should this court...
What do you do with Pacific States and Luther that basically say the determination of what is a Republican form of government is for Congress?
Your Honor, the text of the Guarantee Clause itself, of course, speaks to the United States as the guarantor, as the enforcer, if you will, of the Guarantee Clause. If the framers had wished to assign this textually, as one of the Baker Carr tests suggests, textually to one or the other of another branch of government, it could have said so. We ended up with a kind of per se rule that emerged from Luther v. Borden and then was unfortunately ratified in Pacific States that that all Guarantee Clause questions are per se political questions. Justice O'Connor's opinion in U.S. versus New York, I think, makes clear that per se doctrine is in very fragile shape under current thinking. But more particularly, in Luther v. Borden, indeed, it was appropriate for the court to defer to Congress because the question there was, what's the legitimate government of Rhode Island? There were competing claims to be the state government there, and I think the court didn't express it in this way at the time, but it was analogous to the recognition of a foreign government. You know, that's a political question appropriately left to the political branch.
Well, it seems to me that certainly at the time of the admission of a state to the Union, that it's certainly in Congress's purview to make a determination that a Republican form of government is guaranteed to the people of that state. But is there any constitutional mechanism by which Congress, as a branch, can continue to exercise a supervisory or an oversight function to make the kind of determinations that are implicit in Judge Seymour's question? Or is that necessarily left?
Your Honor, I think this is
Article 3.
This is an Article 3 question, as with any question about what did Congress intend when it passed a law. So the 43rd Congress, I believe it was, in passing the Enabling Act in 1875, used these words, that Colorado must have a Republican form of government. Subsequent Congresses generally don't get in the business of explaining what prior Congresses meant. We rely on the courts and on the, as in the Zipotowski case, the traditional business of federal courts to determine what the law means, both the U.S. Constitution and the federal statutes. If I may, Judge Seymour, not, I don't want to leave Pacific States unaffected by my comments. There, I think the critical issue as it was framed was whether or not by adopting initiative and referendum in Oregon in the progressive era, the entire state government had been infected, and the challenge in Pacific States was to the state as a state. And in that framing of it, it made some sense for the court there to rely on Luther because it had that quality of a challenge to the legitimacy of state government. That's not our case. We are not challenging the initiative process. We are not challenging how Tabor was enacted. We're challenging what Tabor does, how it has restructured the government of Colorado. Should we get to the point, and I hope we do, where your colleagues below are required to determine that meeting, I think there are manageable standards helpfully put forward by the brilliant people that framed the Constitution. Madison made it very clear that state governments with legislatures and manifesting representative government were critical elements that were contemplated by the Guarantee Clause. Justice Hamilton made it very clear, coming out of the dysfunctionality of the Articles of Confederation, that the power to tax was absolutely essential, and a government without the power to tax essentially was not legitimate. This case is about restoring Colorado's birthright and enforcing its responsibility to maintain that Republican form of government. In Reynolds versus Sims, the Supreme Court noted that state legislatures historically have been the fountainhead of representative democracy in this country. A legislature with the requisite powers to maintain its Republican nature is essential to our compliance with the Constitution and the Enabling Act, and we must not let that fountainhead be turned into a figurehead. Last week we celebrated Constitution Day, the founding of the Republic. And as Ben Franklin said, a republic if we can keep it. I pray this court will permit us to go forward in that cause. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel.
Judge Seymour, you asked a question that may be frustrating, but is absolutely necessary, which is what to do about Pacific States. Pacific States is still good law. Pacific States was reinforced in Baker, not undermined. Counsel is absolutely right that New York versus U.S. is the case where Justice O'Connor suggested some question about the wisdom of a per se rule, but absolutely left it in place. This court's decision, I think, in Hansen versus Wyatt shows about as far as the federal courts can go under New York on this question. And what the court said in Hansen was that courts may have some discretion to essentially skip the justiciability question and dismiss a case on the merits. But what it didn't say was what the plaintiffs needed to say here, which is that Pacific States is overruled. And so perhaps this will be the case where the plaintiffs can convince the Supreme Court on a cert petition to reverse Pacific States, but it's still good law. And while the Supreme Court certainly could have written a decision that counsel, that the plaintiffs, that the law professors think it should have written, what it actually wrote was a very clear, broad opinion. And this makes sense given the historical context.
But don't we have to always read opinions in the context in which they were written?
Absolutely. And the context.
Is that a distinguishing factor here?
The distinguishing factor, I don't think there's anything in Pacific States to distinguish the holding, the clear holding, which was that the province, it is not the province of the federal courts to try to redraw these lines. And at the time, the Pacific States came up in the middle of this progressive movement, adding all these limitations of all types to state constitutions, implementing direct democracy. And what the Pacific States Court was doing was pulling the federal courts out of that. This case is an attempt to pull them back in, but until the Supreme Court says that it's willing to do that, Pacific States still controls. A couple of other points before I run out of time. One, the Walker case makes a very important point that counsel referenced. Number one, it says that it could imagine few tasks less appropriate to federal courts than deciding which state constitutional limits affect important governmental interests and which don't. That is precisely what the plaintiffs are asking this court to do here. Say taxation, and it's not, again, it's important, it's not taxation as a whole. Tabor doesn't say no taxes in Colorado. It at most says we're going to add a new check on increasing taxes. We pay plenty of taxes in Colorado. It's not that we're a voluntary state. So it's additional taxes that are affected at most by Tabor. Council, I think, has acknowledged that the way Tabor actually works is as I described, that it's not a flat prohibition on the legislature participating in taxation decisions at all. It's just that it works through referendum rather than simply the legislature being able to impose taxes itself. Council also pointed to a Michael versus Anderson case a couple of times. It's prominent in the briefs. That is a case that the Raines Court specifically mentioned and then proceeded to overrule. So I don't think it's a good fount for standing here. Finally, I'll just make one point about the Enabling Act. First, it's simply not true that the Supreme Court has never held an act of Congress to present a political question. Pacific States itself has exactly the same kind of claim based on Oregon's Enabling Act that we have here, and the court recognized that it raised all the same problems. And so, if I may just close, this case raises interesting issues, but not any that can be resolved by the federal courts.
Thank you, counsel. Thank you all for your attendance this morning and participation. We will take a 10-minute break at this time.